A thought occurred to me, I could just kick the bastard, he's so close. But it was just a whim, I realized immediately that I wouldn't do such a thing on purpose. Although I was angry, I didn't want to harm anyone or anything, and I sure didn't want to get myself in trouble with these things that had such power over me. I realized then that I was naked, even as one of the workers put a too familiar apparatus over my groin. Oh, boy, semen extraction again. I was far from thrilled. It's difficult to tell you how abusive this feels. The supervisor sensed my apprehension and I could feel the screen image percolating. He looked over toward a doorway, and two very attractive young women entered the room, petite with beautiful dark hair and skin-tight blue jeans. The mere sight of them bore a shock straight to the old reptile brain of Jim Sparks. They were almost a parody of what I liked in beautiful women. Clearly these beings could read every centimeter of my mind. One even wore the kind of silver and turquoise jewelry I find attractive on women. They seemed so real. One of them ran her fingers through my hair and stroked my face. She turned to the other woman who was staring down adoringly at me and said, "My, isn't he handsome?" Well, that proved they weren't real. Still, it was easy to fall into the illusion. They stroked me and gave me pleasure, and then a warm, mild electrical shock coursed through my testicles and I ejaculated. This shook off the spell, and the sense of abuse came over me again. Figure 24, viewing the alien hybrids for the first time, "We're not dead, Jim," she said. I was still frightened, but not in any kind of panicky way, and then, mercifully, I just blacked out. When I got back my consciousness, I was on an examination table myself, lying on my back, propped up at a 45-degree angle. A worker stood by, and a supervisor stood right next to my leg. "This isn't natural," I yelled. Almost reflexively, I jerked away and tried to get away, and my leg kicked up, hard, into the supervisor beside me. This startled me as much as it did him. The two women beside me vanished into thin air. I fell back onto the table, upset and maybe even contrite, but I noticed that all signs of any kind of reality overlay had been smacked away. Gone were all the false images. The supervisor suddenly seemed frail, atrophied. His large head was a mass of wrinkles, like those of some very old man. 137, 136, the keepers, and I got an incredible jumble of thought beams projected at me from him. "How could you do that to me? You know better. You should have known better. I trusted you. You betrayed my trust in you. You betrayed my trust in you. You disappointed us. Did you try to disappoint us? You did this on purpose. You tried to hurt me. Why would you want to hurt me? Don't you know this is bad?" On and on in a gush, a stream, a mind blast. Chapter 17, 100 of these phrases ripped out, complete with emotion. I felt and heard each and every phrase clearly, all in 1 second. I was numbed. Laying back on the table, I knew I'd never forget how those ancient, strange eyes had looked at me. Acceleration. Why the hard way again? That, after all, was the way they'd brought me here this time, onto the moonlit beach, then directly on board. Maybe they just couldn't deal with me. Back in the quiet pre-dawn hours at my beach home, I felt exhausted, overcome and of two minds about this whole experience. On one hand I was elated. I'd been able to explore their ship a bit, I was moving forward. I'd had a different experience. At the same time I felt depressed. Maybe I'd blown the whole thing. Maybe I'd failed a test. Of course, even if I'd hurt the supervisor, it wasn't badly. And since they knew me through and through, they must have known I didn't intend to hurt him. And even then they knew they were doing things to me that I felt were abusive and I was simply reacting to them. Still, I couldn't shake the feeling that although there was a strong possibility I'd taken a big step forward after 6.5 years of confusion, there had been a bit of a slip. The big relief at this point was that it was 1994, not 1989. I had someone to share all this with, Tim, and the group. Maybe I'd share it with them later, I thought, as I eased off to sleep with those images of the creature things on the examination table fading away into dreams. I was taking these changes better, I thought, as I finally fell asleep. It was still culture shock, yes, but something inside me was tough now and trained to take this mental and emotional punishment. 138, this way, please, pine resin. I smelled the sharp smell of trees and the bitter taste of dead leaves, moss, weeds and ocean, with a touch of swamp. I was in the woods, a deciduous forest of some sort, it seems, with just a touch of a cool breeze. There were oaks and pines beneath an overcast night sky. I stood in a large clearing. What was I doing here? I didn't recall at first. But then I remembered the whirl and rush of acceleration. This was an abduction, but I had been brought here instead of on board a craft. Details, I told myself. I have to remember details. By now, of course, I realized how important it was that I cling to my memories, as most abductees I'd met had had a hard time with that. If my experiences could help others, or accomplish something, then the pain of my experiences would count toward others learning, maybe even help humankind. This kind of thinking wasn't actually purely altruistic. Frankly, it helped me keep my sanity. Okay. Details. The clearing where I stood was maybe half the size of a football field. There was more than the breeze sighing through the tree branches, though. There was the dreadful sound of people crying and moaning. Alarmed, I looked down. There were maybe 15 people sprawled on the ground around my feet. I turned at another sound, and saw that there was also a young man standing to my right. The people on the ground were both men and women. Most of them were in their night 139, the keeper's clothes, a few were nude. The guy to my right, though, wore a short-sleeve white dress shirt, dark dress slacks and leather shoes. He had dark hair and medium build. Although he was standing, he was paralyzed, except that he could speak. He was panicked, and he murmured, "The last thing I remember was driving home in my car." The people on the ground had clearly been abducted from their sleep. They lay paralyzed, disoriented but completely conscious. There was an exception. A blonde-haired woman in the group was in fetal position, rocking back and forth on the ground and screaming uncontrollably, only partially paralyzed. For some reason, I was calm. As my eyes adjusted to the dark pools around me, I could see that about 20 yards to the left another dozen people were sprawled on the ground. Above them stood an alien, 20 yards to the left of that group were another dozen or so people. Detail, three piles of disoriented people in a clearing, barely dressed or naked. I was determined to remember this. The young man standing by me was losing control, shrieking terribly. An alien appeared beside me, and I heard his telepathic communication, "Calm him." "Me?" I said. "Are you giving me a job?" Again the alien said, "Calm him." As he seemed truly bent out of shape and I certainly understood what that could be like, I figured I should at least try, although I doubted my efficacy in the matter. I grabbed his arm and said, "You'll be okay." "I feel sick," he said. "My stomach is sick." "That's normal after just being transported," I told him, trying to sound reassuring. "It happens to me all the time, but it quickly passes." "I'm so scared," he said. "Yes. I know how that feels. The same thing happened to me. Try hard not be scared. You'll be just fine. You'll be okay. This way, please." 140, 141, I continued my soothing words. He began to calm down. I was truly astonished that I could do this. The blonde woman on the ground seemed to be even more distraught now, though, rocking back and forth. Then the alien said, "Calm her." I could move. I realized then what was happening. I was being trusted again. I hadn't blown it when I'd freaked and kicked the supervisor alien. I leaned over and placed my hand on the girl's shoulder. "You'll be okay. They'll take you aboard their ship and teach you things. A new alphabet. Numbers. Symbols. No. You are telling her too much. Just calm her." I continued to do my best to soothe her with calming words. As I talked to her, I heard others on the ground moaning and crying in fear. I felt overwhelmed. One of the people cried, "Look! The ships! They're coming!" I looked up. Above us were three balls of light, glowing within the low clouds. One streaked from the horizon to hover just above us, as though on cue. The others followed. Then, majestically, one descended. For all the stuff you see in movies or pictures, being there in the flesh makes all the difference in actually experiencing them. This was the case with this vessel, this thing that others might call a UFO. Silently and gracefully it descended in gorgeous, magnificent splendor. Its beauty took my breath away. It was a large metallic sphere with a streamlined dome. The egg-shaped bottom, slightly out of proportion with the rest of the ship, lowered. I saw windows containing the silhouettes of humanoids. Some figures stared down at us, others scurried about. The most astounding thing of all was the light radiating from the bottom, intensely bright white with a bluish hue. I was witnessing some sort of mass abduction in process. I have to say I was spellbound by the sight. I walked forward a few feet trying to get closer. The second ship came down and hovered further down the field. The third ship did the same, hovering above the final group. I thought maybe I'd been trained for just such a moment. I tried to signal the ships in the symbology I had learned, tracing it in the air. I blacked out. When I awoke, I found myself in a large foyer. Beside me was the group of people I'd stood among, totally zombied out. Lead them. There was only one way to go. I headed down a corridor and sure enough, these people followed. The hallway felt like something on a ship, it felt familiar. At the end of it was a huge room buzzing with activity. Inside there were rows and rows of computer monitors, each fronted with seats and a work desk. There were already some people in the front. Each of the monitors displayed the same picture. It reminded me of a NASA control room or a TV sales room. Seat them. I did my best. It seemed automatic almost, the way I was familiar with this whole setup. These guys were a class of many, though, and I'd always been a class of one. Even as I put them into their seats one by one, I noted the monitors going blank. It was rather nice knowing exactly what I was supposed to do and performing my function competently. Soon my group was all seated. As soon as the last person was down, I blacked out again. I reawakened to discover myself in a chair. Gee, I thought, all they needed to do was to tell me to sit, and I would have done it. Or maybe not. I had been scanning the whole room, getting curious again. On my screen and the screens of those around me erupted a color image showing a vibrant green forest with old-growth trees, backed by mountains in the background, with a clear, crisp blue sky. All this was majestically beautiful, as were the following images: a clear lake, a fantastic waterfall, a rainforest, settings of nature here on planet Earth. I lost my objectivity and became mesmerized. I felt the intense fabulousness of it all. It was like an amazing slideshow. We all got a few seconds of each image and then it moved onward. A Viewmaster, 142, 143, the Keeper's Experience Supreme. But then, the scenes began to repeat. Blemishes began to appear in the scenes. Brown foam in the lakes and rivers. Blackened waste in the forest. Skies became nasty and grey. I felt a depression weigh upon me. Then, dead fish, bloated and floating in the turgid mess in a lake. Such was the change from elation to depression that I couldn't look anymore. You are killing your planet, said the voice inside my head. Your planet is dying. At the bottom edge of each image was a symbol. To combat the depression I felt, I started trying to translate these alien symbols, cataloging symbols, I supposed. No. I can't tell you how emphatic and truthful this environmental message was. I felt it with every fiber of my biology. True, so true, and yet I tried to deny it, focusing on the symbols as the images spun out their awful story. I blacked out. On the other side of unconsciousness I was in a smaller room, rather like a locker room, complete with benches. My group of people surrounded me, all naked. All showing fresh scars from surgical procedures, usually concave pieces of flesh removed from forearms or calves. These wounds, I remembered from the support group and my own experience, heal, often showing no lasting scar, but the people in the group were whimpering with terror. An alien walked in and told me, calm them. I did the best I could. But my words did seem to help. Then another alien entered. Find and put on your OWN clothes. You'd think that, as orderly as the aliens are, the clothes would be neatly folded and stacked. Alas, no, they were mixed up and thrown all over, but the great task of finding and covering their nakedness helped put aside any panic. That was it. My job was done, and soon, after acceleration, I was back on my familiar sofa. But this time I felt different, even good. I felt an odd enjoyment of the experience, and an 144, this way, please accomplishment. I felt as though I had a place in whatever strange scheme was happening. Unfortunately, there was one problem: my right eye was sore. I didn't remember bumping it, but that meant nothing. I'd conked out a lot on this last abduction and could have hit a few things, but there were also those bright lights. My next thought was about Dim, and how glad I was that I was going to be able to share this with him. My eye was still hurting when I saw him, but we were too excited about this whole experience to discuss my eye problem or go to a doctor. Tim was so thrilled with my story that he insisted that I let him hook me up with Bud Hopkins. You have to meet Bud, he said. This is much too important. I agreed. I was starting to see more of how I fit into all this, and how I had to share with more people other than just the group. There was a reason behind all this. My eye continued to hurt. I saw a doctor. He gave me eye drops, which helped to soothe and heal the eye in a matter of days. But I'll never forget his question after examining me. Has this eye been exposed to bright lights recently? 145, THEGFT, Chapter 18. This time, however, there wasn't a bit of me that was paralyzed, and I was unattended. I made no effort to explore like last time. I'd wait here to see what they had in mind. Sure enough, in a little while two supervisors appeared, holding a black box, a perfect cube. The psychic radiation of their presence was a little upsetting, but I got a hold of myself and didn't panic. Look, a gift for you. One of the aliens took the black box and laid it on the table, and I noticed again how long and slender his fingers were. A gift? I said. What do you want me to do with it? Do with it as you will. They turned and left me with that box. I remember that although I was free to move around, I did feel a little foggy-headed. I had no sense of danger from the box, and I was curious, so I tried to open it. Alas, it seemed to have no lid. I tried to wrest it open, but no luck. I thought about banging it against the table, but I didn't want the aliens to think I was staring up there. The gift I'd heard of Bud Hopkins, of course, from other members of the group. I didn't read his books, as people suggested I might, because even then I had the sense that I had a unique mission and view of the whole alien scenario, one that I was just working out. I honestly feel, and still feel to a lesser extent, that reading too much other material will sully and confuse my memories. Marianne, one of the members of my alien support abduction group, agreed with Tim that I should talk with Bud. More than that, she knew an easy way to contact him. She had a summer home in Cape Cod, close to where Hopkins spent the month of August each year. She knew him well and invited me to stay with her and meet Bud there. Hopkins had spent 17 years studying alien abduction phenomena and had figured importantly in Whitley Strieber's exposure of the whole business to national media attention through Communion. He had written the bestseller Missing Time. When I agreed to go, it was fairly quiet. Summer of 1994 saw no abductions. Rather than compromise myself totally, though, instead of actually reading it through, I just perused passages here and there to get the gist. I must say, even this reading process turned up some amazing similarities to my own story. Well, maybe not so amazing, since it merely confirmed to me the veracity of my own memory. A few days before I was to head north, though, I was pulled. I found myself in the same teaching room as before. 146, figure 26. Being given the gift, 147, ship. After pushing and pulling didn't work, I just put it on the table and stared at it. Then I realized the one thing I hadn't tried was a gentle exploratory method. Sure enough, I gently grasped the lid and played with it, pulling it toward me. It slid off. Well, I just hope that wasn't an intelligence test, because I probably scored pretty darned low. I noticed a foul odor rising. In the box were about 6 or 7 upright, long glass tubes. Each tube was about 1 inch to 1.5 inches in diameter. In the bottom lay a thick, dark brown, sticky, smelly fluid, about 2 inches deep. The alien returned and stared. I broke eye contact, not because I was frightened but just to be safe. What is that dark stuff? It's your gift. We extracted it from your lungs. From my lungs? This trash was in my lungs? I really didn't know what to think. Could this really be true? It's possible because at that time I was indeed a smoker. I didn't know what to say. Follow us, one instructed me. They took me into another room and instructed me to stay. I just stood there in the dark, then I blacked out. When I awoke, I was in another room, this one well lit. I could move, but only in a kind of slow motion. Peripherally I noticed that there was another woman in the room. It seemed to be Teresa. Then, I was aware of the slender fingers of an alien touching me and guiding me to another part of the room, so that the woman was out of my range of vision. The alien, definitely a supervisor, led me to a wall. There stood a full-length mirror that seemed to be the sort they have in dressing rooms. The alien stood me in front of this mirror and said, "Look." The figure in the mirror was me, only altered, and not distorted, like a funhouse mirror. My hair is dark brown, full and thick. The image showed me with thin dark brown hair, 148, mixed with blonde. My chin seemed pointier. My image had no eyebrows, and my mustache was gone. My eyes were slightly larger, and my body more frail. "What is this all about?" I asked. I got no answer, and I didn't push it. Baffled, but happy to know that I'd be able to talk about this with an expert like Bud Hopkins, I just paid attention as best I could. Soon I was transported back. I found myself back home, and the clock read 5:30 a.m., safe and sound. The whole thing had been somewhat of a gift, after so long, a refresher abduction to remind me of details, just days before my trip to Cape Cod. I'd be able to report things absolutely vividly. Cape Cod was gorgeous in August, with the Atlantic breezes smelling clean and the sun giving off a much more pleasant kind of heat than muggy old Florida. Marianne was a splendid hostess and showed me the places in the area where she'd actually been abducted from her car. One of her abductions had been especially harrowing, but in general she dealt with the whole experience well, using them to help others cope. I learned that one of the reasons she'd done so well with this whole thing was that she'd had a very supportive family who actually believed her and did the things to keep her together in the first harrowing experiences. I felt a little bit envious. Although my main purpose here was to meet Bud Hopkins, Marianne wanted me to talk to another contactee to whom the aliens had shown their symbols. I'd shown very few symbols to my group and generally kept them to myself, reasoning, perhaps faultily, that if I found another person who knew the same alien symbols without having me disseminating them beforehand, it would be 100% rock-hard evidence that my experiences weren't just extremely vivid hallucinations. Sure enough, the person Marianne wanted me to meet kept a meticulously sketched record of the symbols she was taught during her abduction experiences. Marianne knew this, and thus linked me up with a terrific lady whom I'll call Sandy. We met, and we were both quite excited about the symbols. She 149. The keepers invited me to her home so we could go over some of her experiences and view some of the symbols she had seen. Sandy is very fastidious. Most of her experiences were kept in diary form, and any alien symbols she remembered, she kept logged and filed. We both became quite excited about one particular abduction experience in which the similarities were astonishingly similar to one of mine. I'll never forget the shock that coursed through me as I looked at two of those symbols, exactly as I remembered them. It was emotionally satisfying, and it made me feel so much less alone. The next night I was to attend a meeting of alien abductees from the New England area, where I would meet Bud Hopkins. This was such a special meeting for me. Bud Hopkins is such a pleasant gentleman. He's graying, avuncular, soft-spoken, and best of all, he listens carefully to you. An extra treat that night was the attendance of David M. Jacobs, author of the book Secret Life. I shared some of my story and listened to others. There were similarities, but also differences, all of which concurred with my opinion of the wide diversity of aliens who are visiting. Afterwards, Bud invited me to come by and talk further. Sipping cold drinks that next day, we focused completely on my story. He was such a pleasure to talk to, and it was gratifying to see how amazed he was by my memory for detail. He asked if I'd had anything odd happen to me before 1988. No, I replied. However, there was one exception. One day in the mid-50s, my mother and I were visiting relatives in New York City. I somehow got lost. I remember a strange man in a suit who offered to help. He took me to his car and we drove around for what seemed at least an hour. We found my mother, and all ended well. However, the odd thing was that to this day my mother swears that I was gone only for a couple of minutes. She'd panicked, looked around for me, and there I was, holding the hand of a man in a dark suit. As I told Bud, my mother was quite overprotective, and it's hard for me to see how she had let me get lost on my own. Also, my memory 150 of that car ride is crystal clear, and a car ride would take much longer than a few minutes. This could be a case of missing time, Bud said. Although I couldn't quite see how it related to my experiences, it did pique Bud's interest. He mentioned that in most cases, encounters with aliens begin in an abductee's childhood. He thought it would be a good idea to explore this further through hypnotic regression. The process could uncover gaps or lost memories. I was a bit nervous at the idea. I'd never been hypnotized before, and I didn't really need it to recall my experiences. I felt I was unique and wanted to keep it that way. Bud understood. He explained that there were myths about hypnotic regression. Debunkers claimed hypnotists lead the individual into believing or recalling events the hypnotist is suggesting. He assured me that this wouldn't happen. He just found that the hypnotic state was a relaxed environment that allowed recollections to occur. Of particular interest to Bud was the gift I had been given. It's a fresh abduction experience, he said, and he wanted to work with it a little bit. I agreed to undergo the hypnotic regression. Bud led me to a small room, just big enough for a comfortable, single bed. Bud instructed me to lie on the bed while he sat in a small chair. There was a small bookshelf against a window with several books atop the sill. I felt relaxed. Bud asked me to close my eyes, to think of a place where I enjoyed being, one that made me feel good. For me, that place has to be on the Gulf Coast in the morning, when gulls are feeding on baked fish that chum the glassy water. After a few minutes of relaxation and soothing words, Bud asked me to talk about my memories of childhood, between the ages of 3 and 4. I did. He asked me to linger there and stand in front of a mirror and tell him what I saw. I must say now that I had the totally wrong idea of what hypnotic regression was. Maybe I had visualized stage hypnotists making people bark like dogs, I don't know, but there on that bed I was completely conscious and totally aware, and I 151 knew I could end the session at any time. Once I was ready, Bud simply asked me to share the story again, the story of how I was lost as a child. Although I was under hypnosis, I pretty much said the same thing and told the story with the same detail as I had before. However, there was one big difference. As Bud asked me questions, and I watched the whole thing unfold again, I described everything. I was watching people through the square window of the vehicle I rode in. What do you see? I see lots of people walking on the sidewalks. I see cars and buildings and I can see the tops of the men's hats. I am saying to the nice man as I look at the women, that's not my mommy, and that's not my mommy. Then it hit me. I almost jumped off that bed. I was viewing the city streets filled with people and traffic all right, but obviously I was up in the air. I was looking down. We were moving, and I was in some sort of craft. The implication here was that the aliens had been keeping track of me since childhood. when the session was over, Bud and I discussed the whole thing. I would like to emphasize that in no way did he plant this memory,